Mike Malloy here on the Surprise, Surprise, Mike Malloy program. Welcome to tonight's gig. Yeah, I still have the bronchitis. Don't let it freak you out. Just don't get too close to however you're listening to me tonight. I want to breathe this stuff on you. The birther thing, I'm still kind of fixated on that from last night, what we were talking about. These crazy people who don't believe that Barack Obama is a citizen, but also the people who think that the healthcare plan has a deather, a death part to it, where federal agents are going to come out, federal agents from Barack Obama, not really federal agents, people who work specifically for Barack Obama because, you know, he is the Antichrist, and going to come out and make old people pick their way of dying. We really live in an insane asylum, just like Greg Palast's book, Armed Madhouse. He has it nailed. I realize that's a line from what? From a Allen Ginsberg poem? Is that where it's from? But, or it's a couple of words, I should say, from Allen Ginsberg poem. Armed Madhouse, which is certainly where we live. But I've been watching some of this stuff on talk television today. Yeah, I know. I don't know why I keep doing this to myself, but just for the sheer hell of it. And the madness out there is just waist deep. This psychopathic twit, Glenn Beck, is really, I mean, he is really, really becoming entertaining. I can't wait. You know what this guy's going to do? He's going to go on his radio or television program one day, and he's going to look into the camera, and he's going to start talking about Barack Obama's a Nazi or a racist or whatever. And all of a sudden, something's going to click, and he's going to reach into the drawer of his desk. He's going to pull out a revolver, put it to his head, and pull the trigger. You know that's going to happen. This guy is insane. Glenn Beck is completely insane. Wouldn't that be fun to watch? Actually, it wouldn't, because if you've ever seen a headshot like that, it is pretty bad. Anyway, Frank Rich, back on last Sunday, I didn't get to this too much on the death of Walter Cronkite. It happened early last week, didn't it? And then I was gone with this lung rot. But Frank Rich was making a pretty good point in his column on Sunday that and I felt the same way, and you probably did too. Thank God for Frank Rich to articulate what you and I think, right? He is good. He's a great writer. You know, he used to be the theater critic at the New York Times until he switched over to writing political commentary. And he brings with him that dramatist-writer flair when he writes about politics. I love his column. It's the first thing I look at Sundays when we get the Times. But he wrote last Sunday that in death, the most trusted man in America, with quotes around that, Walter Cronkite, has been embalmed in that most comforting of American sweeteners, nostalgia, to the point where his finest and most discomforting achievements are being sanitized and forgotten. We've heard much sentimental rumination on the bygone heyday of the mainstream media, on the critical fractionalization inflicted by the Internet, and on the lack of any man who could replicate the undisputed moral authority of Uncle Walter. Women still need not apply, apparently. But the reason to celebrate Cronkite has little to do with any of this, and least of all to do with his avuncular television persona. What mattered about Cronkite is that he knew when to stop being reassuring Uncle Walter and to challenge those who betrayed the audience's trust. He had the guts to confront not only those in power, but his own bosses. Given the American press's catastrophe of our own day, its failure to unmask or even question the White House propaganda campaign that plunges into Iraq, given all that, these attributes are as timely as ever. But Rich goes on to talk about this, about how there's nobody in media, right, in television or radio media. Let's stick with television broadcast because that's where he worked. Who who is going to speak truth to power that has an audience like Cronkite had. Now, granted, Keith Olbermann will do that, but, you know, not to take anything away from Olbermann, he might reach 700,000 people on a typical broadcast, whereas Walter Cronkite reached what? 8 million? 10 million? Plus, what Cronkite said mattered. What Olbermann says is entertaining and important and pungent and acerbic and slash and burn, and I love his show, but it's not Walter Cronkite. It doesn't make any difference that Keith Olbermann uses the same tagline that Edward R. Murrow used, you know, good night, good luck. Sorry, Keith, as much as I love your program, well, you get the point. But Rich goes on, and he says, in the case of Vietnam, Cronkite began as a reliable mouthpiece for all those optimistic scenarios purveyed by the Johnson administration. It was the contradiction and chaos that Cronkite saw in a visit to Vietnam after the Tet Offensive way back in 68 that tardily changed his mind. Even now, right-wing bloggers who still think we could have won in Vietnam are busy trashing Cronkite. They missed the point of what he said in his on-air editorial. He didn't presume to judge the outcome of the Tet Offensive itself. He viewed the war as a whole as a stalemate. And he was right. I mean, when we talk about the United States was handed defeat in Vietnam, only in the sense that we didn't win. I mean, we just cut and run. At some point, after what, 9 years? And close to 60,000 of our own dead, and 3 million Indochinese, we left. So, as Rich says, what really outraged Cronkite was more elementary than any prognostication. He saw that the American government was lying to its own people. Cronkite said, quote, "We have been too often disappointed by the optimism of the American leaders, both in Vietnam and Washington, to have faith any longer in the silver linings they find in the darkest clouds," end quote. And he made a point of letting his audience, and by extension, millions of other people know, that Cronkite knew, and he passed it on, that the government of the United States was lying through its goddamn teeth. Now, who? Who? In broadcast media, did that during Dick Cheney's masturbatory fantasy of invading two countries? Who did that? Who did that? 3, 2, 1. That's right. Nobody. Nobody. And there's a reason for it, of course. It's the reason we've talked about time and time and time again on this program. Because we don't have journalists sitting in those anchor chairs anymore. We have people who are paid by corporate America to help us forget. And it doesn't make any difference what the topic is. Unless it's Michael Jackson's death, then we are not to forget. We are to talk about that event for what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, without let up. So, in a sense, the anchors today on the three broadcast networks and most of the talking heads on cable news are doing a better job than Walter Cronkite. But the job description has changed. Cronkite's objective, his charge, the reason that a free press is in the First Amendment, was to speak truth to power, to challenge, to force the administration, whether it was city mayor's office or the federal government, to be honest, to tell the truth, to stop lying. That was Cronkite's job. What do you think is the job of Brian Williams or Katie Couric or who's the other guy? Who's the guy on ABC, Kathy? I don't even know. It doesn't matter. What do you think their job is? Do you think their job is to tell the truth to the lying son of a bitches who operate inside our government? Has it been in the past 25 years? No, it has not. The job of the anchors today, dropped my microphone. The object or the function or the purpose of the anchors today is to make us forget, make us not even become a little bit aware of what's going on. And certainly never under any circumstances to speak truth to power. Never. Celebrate the next 100 years of engineering excellence at the GMC Summer Event. Check out the legendary 09 Sierra 1500 or the 8-passenger Acadia. Visit gmcdealer.com. Take delivery by July 31st. See dealer for details.
Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang.
21 past the hour. So back to the Frank Rich thing here. He goes on to say in his column last Sunday, to appreciate how special Cronkite's achievements were, consider our recent past. As the Bush administration hyped Saddam's non-existent weapons of mass destruction and non-existent link to 9/11, the New York Times and the Washington Post too often enabled these fictions. But at least some reporters at these two papers and others elsewhere were onto the hoax, even if their findings were buried in the back pages. At the networks, Cronkite's heirs were not even practicing journalism. They invited administration propagandists onto their programs to trumpet their tales of imminent mushroom clouds with impunity. And not much changed after the invasion, when Ted Koppel, then of ABC News, dared to merely recite the names of the American dead on Nightline a year into the war, the assault from Bush-Cheney allies, including in the broadcast industry, was so fierce that Koppel's peers retreated from the fray. In the months when it might have made a difference, no network television anchor challenged the administration's silver linings in Iraq as Cronkite had challenged LBJ's in Vietnam. And Rich lists a couple of instances. You know, when, what's his name? Who used to host Meet the Press? The guy that died? Tim Russert, yeah. And he's referred to by a lot of people, or he was when he was alive, as media whore number one. There are a lot of reasons for that, and they were all valid. We have a new media whore number one, that's David Gregory. As Rich points out, some journalists even fawn over the worst and the stupidest. As email released by Mark Sanford's office revealed, he's the governor that got his thingy caught in some other woman's dress zipper, as an email released by Mark Sanford's office revealed that David Gregory of NBC News tried to get an interview with this sleazy governor by reassuring him that, quote, Meet the Press allows you to frame the conversation how you really want to, end quote. That's what David Gregory said to Mark Sanford. Meet the Press allows you to frame the conversation how you really want to. So anyway, I did want to mention that because when I read Rich's column last Sunday through a fog of drugs and antibiotics and stuff, you know, I thought this is so true. Once again, I mean, Rich, every time Rich writes a column, he nails whatever the subject is, absolutely nails it to the floor. And because I was uncomfortable, too, weren't you, listening to these cheesy multi-million-dollar-a-year anchor people praising Walter Cronkite because he took off his glasses and looked at the clock and noted the time of Kennedy's death, because he looked into the camera, took off his glasses, and kind of gleefully smiled, oh my, when people landed on the moon, and so on and so forth, completely missing the point that they couldn't carry Walter Cronkite's jockstrap. None of these people could. Man, have we come a long way from the Cronkite era. You know, another example of what our media should be attacking, these filthy corporations. Judges, a guy named Christopher Everett, he was a sergeant in the Army. And he was electrocuted in Iraq because he was using equipment from Kellogg Brown and Root. In some instances, the sole provider of resources to our people in Iraq. And, of course, it's Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney still sucks off as much money as he can from them. But judges in Texas and Florida have dropped KBR from lawsuits brought by the family of this soldier who was electrocuted in Iraq. The company announced today, I'm sure they announced it gleefully, Sergeant Christopher Everett died while using a power washer at an American base outside Ramadi in western Iraq. Kellogg Brown and Root was one of the contractors Everett's family sued in connection with his death. The federal courts in Louisiana and Texas threw out the family's claims against the Houston-based company. Why, of course. What do you think a court would do? Allow such a lawsuit to go forward? Why, my goodness. That might reveal the corruption that is bone deep inside the military-industrial complex in this country and the connection of so many politicians, most of whom are Republicans, but a hefty chunk of whom are Democrats. The incredible connections, the web of connections between lawmakers, quote, and these massive corporations who don't give a goddamn what American soldier dies under what circumstances, just give me the check. It's about 25 before the hour on the Malloy program. What else we got here? This is interesting. From dollarsandcents.org, the real unemployment rate, I was listening to some of Barack Obama's sales pitch today for the kind of health care that we might be a stopgap measure on the road to single payer, but I certainly have mixed emotions about it. But I was listening to him. In addition to the questions from the crazy people in the audience, the ones who watch this psychopathic Glenn Beck or listen to this drug dealing Limbaugh or the rest of the pigs, but their questions were amusing, except for the fact that these people are serious. They want to know if Barack Obama's health care plan is going to include plan to send people out to the house to put them to death or offer them a choice. Do you want the bullet or the noose? What would you like, old lady? Jesus Christ. But he started out today in his speech by saying that if you saw the recent issue of Newsweek magazine, it said the recession is over. And everybody in the audience kind of embarrassed. This is in North Carolina, I think in Raleigh, and they kind of chuckled like, what? Yeah, what? I don't know what the hell Newsweek was talking about. I don't subscribe to Newsweek because I don't like their editorial staff. And I don't like Mort Zuckerman, who is an absolute Zionist, who I believe he's still the owner of Newsweek. But he's very irritating, and I don't like him. So I don't subscribe to Newsweek. For that matter, I don't subscribe to Time either. Not that you care, but I'm just saying. So anyways, describing this this cover of Newsweek that says the recession is over, something to that effect, and everybody kind of went, Well, then there's this from dollarsandcents.org. It says that the real unemployment rate has hit a 68-year high. That goes back to, what, 1941? It's right before the advent of World War II. The article says, although you have to dig into the statistics to know it, unemployment in the United States is now worse than at any time since the end of the Great Depression. From December 2007, when this writer says the recession began, to May of this year, 6 million U.S. workers lost their jobs. The big three U.S. automakers are closing plants and letting white-collar workers go, too. Chrysler, the worst off of the three, will lay off one quarter of its workforce, even if it survives. Heavy equipment manufacturer Caterpillar and giant banking conglomerate Citigroup have both laid off thousands of workers. Alcoa, the aluminum maker, has let workers go. Computer maker Dell and express shipper DHL have both canned many of their workers. Circuit City, the leading electronics retailer, went out of business, costing its 40,000 workers their jobs. Lawyers and large national firms are getting the axe. Even on Sesame Street, workers are losing their jobs. And then it skips down to this. Some groups of workers are already facing official unemployment rates in the double digits. As of May, unemployment rates for Black, Hispanic, and teenage workers were already 14.9%, 12.7%, and 22.7%, respectively. 14.9 for Black folks, 12.7 for Hispanics, 22.7 for teenagers. Workers without a high school diploma confronted a 15.5% unemployment rate, while the unemployment rate for workers with just a high school diploma was 10%. Nearly one in five construction workers, 19.2%, were unemployed. In Michigan, the hardest hit state so far, unemployment was at 12.9% in April, and unemployment rates in seven other states were at double-digit levels as well. It's scary stuff, and when a magazine like Newsweek, that must be run by inmates at a primate research facility, I mean, my God, the recession's over? What are you talking about? Well, what? I haven't read the article, so I have no idea what they're basing the screwy headline on. The cover headline, the cover tease, but the recession is over. Really? Oh, I've had my first major error tonight. The Washington Post owns Newsweek. Mort Zuckerman owns U.S. News and World Report. Hello! That's from our research department who fired off that email to me. Just when you think you know everything, right? Yeah. I know. It's the Tussinex I'm taking. No, it's not. I thought Zuckerman owned Newsweek for a moment there. Thanks, research department. I appreciate it. Wall Street Journal today. No, not today. Last Wednesday. Concentration of wealth at the top of the food chain in this country is draining Social Security. You know what that means? The nation's wealth gap is widening amid an uproar about lofty pay packages in the financial world. Here's what it says. Executives and other highly compensated employees now receive more than one-third of all pay in the United States. That's according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of Social Security Administration data. And it doesn't count the billions of dollars more in pay that remains off federal radar screens, the radar screens that measure wages and salaries. More than one-third of all pay in the United States now goes to these executives and highly compensated employees. These employees received nearly $2.1 trillion of the $6.4 trillion in total U.S. pay in 2007. This doesn't even talk about 2008 or this year. The compensation numbers don't include incentive stock options or unexercised stock options or uninvested restricted stock units and certain other benefits. Now, the pay of employees who receive more than the Social Security wage base, that's at $106,800 now. The pay of employees who receive more than that increased by 78%, or nearly $1 trillion over the past decade, exceeding the 61% increase for other workers. And then it says, the growing portion of pay that exceeds the maximum amount subject to payroll taxes has contributed to the weakening of the Social Security Trust Fund. In May, just passed, the government said the Social Security Fund would be exhausted in 2037, 4 years earlier than they predicted just last year. So what does that mean? Well, it means one simple thing, that there should not be a cap on wages subject to Social Security tax, doesn't it? I mean, come on. If you make over $106,800, you pay no more Social Security tax. If you make $20 million a year, for moving numbers around on a screen, not even real numbers, digital numbers, as you rape and pillage the commodities market or stock trading, this hyper stock trading now that takes little bits and slices here and there, wherever it can, by working at the speed of light. If you do that enough and you make yourself $10 million, you only pay Social Security tax on the first $106,000. That sucks, doesn't it? Huh? So all that wealth that's clustering in the hands of a few at the very top of the food chain has the unintended effect of unintended effect of denying money into the Social Security Trust Fund that's desperately needed. Meanwhile, the vampires who continue to take $10 million a year in bonuses, what the hell do you do for $10 million in bonuses when you work for a financial services firm? Please. But the people who continue to take that kind of pay, that kind of money, out of the vast pool of wages available, are ensuring that the Social Security system is going to collapse. Even as they and their ilk talk about, well, the Social Security system is going to collapse because it's underfunded. Well, you greedy sons of bitches. You greed heads, you filthy greed heads. It's underfunded because of people like you. Now, again, we've said this before, and when I've said it before, I'm only quoting historians. I know nothing about what I talk about except what I read in the on Wikipedia. But historically, in any society, when wage disparity or earnings disparity, it doesn't necessarily have to be wages, whatever the earning system is, when it becomes so great that you have a class at the very top, pick a number, 1%, 2%, 3%, that controls vast amounts of wealth, and the other 95, 96, 97% are struggling for a living, eventually that explodes, and you have revolution. There's no way to get around that. I mean, it's an historical fact. It's as much a part of history as any other historical truth you can come across. I guess the super wealthy figure that they'll just hire a private army, and they're okay. It's a special club for the privileged few. Not for me, not for you. It's a wonderful life. No stress, no strife. Never hurry, never worry like the poor folk do. And oh, it must be fun to be so wealthy, filthy, rich and young. One might wonder what great things they've done to become the fortunate ones. They're the happy members of the Lucky Sperm Club. The only thing they have to do is be conceived. It's great to be a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. Living in the lap of lazy luxury. Sing. Fears that we will die. celebrate the next 100 years of engineering excellence at the GMC Summer Event. Check out the legendary 09 Sierra 1500 or the 8-passenger Acadia. Visit GMCDealer.com. Take delivery by July 31st. See dealer for details. It's about 9:30 before the hour. I think we talked about this before, about farmed fish. Anyone who eats farmed fish deserves whatever kind of toxic soup you're getting in the flesh of that animal. It's just horrifying. And it doesn't make any difference if it's in farmed fish that come from South America or South Alabama. It is poisonous crap. You know, it's one thing to farm cows or sheep or, you know, domestic animals, but to farm fish is, it, the idea itself is insane. I mean, you know, to put fish in pens where they're all going to get sick, and then to load them up with antibiotics and of course, since they're in water for the most part that comes from a dammed up stream or a dammed up river or part of a lake, it's going to be full of pesticide wash off. So every time I go to my friendly supermarket here in the South, it's either Publix or Kroger or, no, I don't know how many we've got. But when I walk past the fish counter and I look at the, you know, this nice, pretty pink salmon, and I think to myself, yeah, you sons of bitches, not only is it full of pesticides and antibiotics, but you put stuff in the water now to make the flesh pink. Because the only way salmon meat is pink to begin with is because of the diet they have out in the ocean, right? Little pink krill, little teeny pink shrimps or whatever the hell they are. So since that's not available in a salmon farm, oh, my God, you know, they throw in some chemical that makes the meat pink. Well, most salmon eaten in the United States comes from industrial aquaculture. Even a word for it. 90% of the salmon consumed in the U.S. comes from factory-style farms, most of it imported. And until recently, our biggest supplier was Chile, whose salmon industry is in a state of collapse. Thank you, God. Having been ravaged by a virus called infectious salmon anemia. Now, Chile's salmon cages runneth over with antibiotics. This was at on Huffington Post. Earlier this year, the Pew Environmental Group obtained some damning FDA documents about the Chilean salmon industry. The documents revealed that, quote, three Chilean salmon farming companies, including the two largest producers of farm salmon, used a number of drugs not approved by the U.S. government. These chemicals include the antibiotics flumiquine and oxalic acid and the pesticide imamectin benzoate. The documents further show that the farm salmon containing residues of unapproved chemicals were destined for the U.S. market. Well, of course. Now, these operations are located in Chile, but they're run by Norwegian agribusiness giants. The three largest producers in Chile have been Marine Harvest of Norway, Cermaq of Norway, and Aqua Chile of Chile. These three represent more than 50% of the market share. But what the Norwegians are doing, for example, according to the Chilean Ministry of Economy, who confirmed excessive use of antibiotics in Chilean farmed salmon, according to that minister's report, Chile used 385,635 kilograms of antibiotics in 2007. Norway used 649. This means that Chile used almost 600 times more antibiotics than the larger Norwegian industry. And it goes on. Now, why am I talking about this? I'm talking about it because some time ago I said that, or I talked about the push because of the fatty acids. What is it, Kathy? Omega-3s? the fatty acids in fish and the fact that we are overfishing the stocks. It's one thing to raise catfish in a freshwater fish in a farm. That I wouldn't even eat, not with your mouth, truth seeker. But ocean going fish like salmon in pens full of disease and antibiotics and pesticides and herbicides and God knows what all has washed in there. Two things you can do, either one or both or neither. If you do eat salmon, and we do, we stop for about 6 months, but we are, again, make sure it's wild caught salmon, especially if it's smoked or canned. And how you're going to tell that, I don't know. A canned salmon, I don't know if they have to label it that way. Or, better yet, for the time being, stop eating it altogether. You know what I mean? You can always take flaxseed oil. That will give you omega-3 too. Won't it, Kathy? Flaxseed oil? Doesn't that do it? Flaxseed oil has omega-3. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. All right. When we come back, we want to tell you about the Senate Armed Services Committee. We'll hold a hearing tomorrow to consider the nomination of somebody to be Secretary of the Army. And you may find this guy to be interesting. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It's just about 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Show. So, if you can do this, you may have to go to C-SPAN 3 to do this if you have it on your cable or satellite system. We don't have it any longer, which is reason enough for me to cancel the satellite service, Kathy, and go back to cable. Because C-SPAN 3 is where these hearings wind up. C-SPAN 1 and 2, they have to show you very important things like votes in the House or the Senate on House H.R. 103 as to whether or not, quacking ducks should be allowed into the country if they come from Argentina or whatever the nonsense is that they're voting on. And if you ever notice on C-SPAN 1 and 2, it's just interminable hours of watching those vote totals go up. And then they have to do the roll call, and then whatever. So tomorrow, July 30th, the Senate Armed Services Committee is going to consider the nomination of a guy named John McHugh. John McHugh. He's a Republican from New York. He has been nominated by President Obama, I guess, to be Secretary of the Army. In a guest editorial written by BJC, what is that, Baptist, I don't know, the director of the BJC, Brent Walker, a Baptist himself, raised serious questions about John McHugh's troubling church-state record. In the editorial, guest editorial last month, this is what was written. He, McHugh, has supported numerous bills and legislation to allow the display of the Ten Commandments on public property, to exploit confusion on the issue of prayer in public schools, including the infamous Istook Amendment that would amend the Constitution to essentially gut the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Representative McHugh also opposed a legislative provision. What does that mean? Oh, well, it's highlighted, and I didn't go to it. Let me go on. McHugh's apparent indifference to church-state separation is especially troubling, given the well-documented controversies over religion in the military, such as religious discrimination and proselytization at the Air Force Academy, inappropriate sectarian activity by military chaplains, religious messages being incorporated in official briefings to former President George Bush and others, stuff that would have required the Secretary of Defense to report instances of improper proselytization of service academy cadets to Congress. End quote from this director of the BJC, himself a Baptist, Brent Walker. McHugh's nomination has been praised and is expected to be confirmed. Secretary of the Army. Another one of these religious nuts. A Republican, right-wing, religious nut to be head Secretary of the Army. Isn't this an issue that deserves some attention? Don't we need to know what his attitude is regarding church-state separation? If you look at his record, church-state separation is a phony construct that doesn't belong in the Constitution. We want this guy as Secretary of the Army? We also need to understand his position where it concerns the Constitution's limits on government as it relates to the recruitment, training, and functioning of the military. In other words, how far are recruiters allowed to go, for example, in telling young, impressionable boys and girls, you know, you need to join the military to fight God's war. You need to be moving onward, Christian soldier, because if you don't, the Muslims and maybe the Jews are going to take over. So how does somebody like this guy get nominated by Barack Obama to be Secretary of the Army? A Republican religious nutcase who insists on allowing the Ten Commandments to be displayed on public property. You know, I've said before where it concerns this dumbass Ten Commandments issue. People who really think the Ten Commandments are something other than the mad ravings of an insane God, and they're not even that. I mean, the mad ravings of a madman who went up in the mountains and came back and said, God, talk to me. Of the Ten Commandments, don't seven of them refer to God? You won't do this. If you do this, I'll break your ass. If you do this, I'll condemn you to hell. You won't do this, you won't do that, right? In addition to being the mad ravings of a mad, insane deity, the Ten Commandments are not the basis of U.S. law, never have been, even though so many of these right-wing freaks will try to convince you that they are the basis of law. No, they're not. They have nothing to do with U.S. law. Nothing. They have nothing to do with any law. They have to do with the ravings of an insane God. That's all. But the Ten Commandments, if someone really believes that they mean something, then my suggestion has always been erect a monument to the Ten Commandments on your front lawn. Tattoo it on your child's ass. Carry a sign that sticks out of your shirt collar, but keep it the hell off of public property. We don't live in a theocracy yet, you morons. And, of course, when I take that approach, for some reason I piss people off. I don't know why. But I really do, especially here in the South. Especially here in the South, where the divorce rate is the highest, the venereal disease rate is the highest, the murder rate is the highest, the armed robbery rate is the highest, the rape rate is the highest. Oh, and the church attendance figures are the highest, too. Correlation there? Of course. It's not even a question. So, if you get a chance, if you have C-SPAN 3 or wherever they're going to show this garbage tomorrow, let's watch the Senate Armed Services Committee consider the nomination of Representative John McHugh, Republican of New York, to be Secretary of the Army. Yeah, that's what we need. A Christian Armageddonist, a rapture-ready freak to be Secretary of the Army. Oh, my God. Or goodness, or whatever. Now, I've got something for you here that you're going to find amazing. If you've been paying attention, you know, a couple of days ago, seven people were arrested in North Carolina, charged with terrorism, plotting to bomb stuff and do suicide bombings in the United States. And the ringleader, apparently, is a guy named Daniel Boyd, who is I think six of them are American citizens, but Daniel Boyd is strictly a white, he's an Anglo, a European American. He's not a swarthy Middle Easterner with a name with all those Y's and A's in it. This guy's name is Daniel Boyd, and he's married to a woman named Sabrina. And what happened to Sabrina is unbelievable. And I want to share that with you when we come back. I mean, I can't completely process this story. It was in the Raleigh News and Observer today. And I think you might have the same bit of difficulty that I had in understanding what happened to this woman, who's a mother of five, born in this country. She's another American citizen, mother of five children. Yeah, she converted to Islam. But wait till you hear what the authorities did to her. Stay right there.
You might have a body of fine proportion and a hungry mind, a handsome face and a flashing whip, lips that kiss and eyes that shine. There might be a line all around the block long before your starting time, but you can't take it with you. You can't take it with you, though you might pile it up high. It's so much easier for a camel to pass through a needle's eye.
The hour. All right, so Daniel Boyd in North Carolina is accused of being a terrorist ringleader. And he and two of his sons and five other people have been charged that they plotted to kill themselves and others in the name of Islam. The wife of Daniel Boyd, her name is Sabrina Boyd, according to the Raleigh News and Observer, she met with a reporter at a restaurant in one of the suburbs of Raleigh yesterday. She sat covered from head to toe in traditional Muslim garb. She and her husband, who years ago had military training in Afghanistan and fought with Muslim rebels against the Soviets, she and her husband were committed to living pure and honest lives, she said. They believed in helping their neighbors, and they attempted on occasion to help the children of immigrant Muslims hold their faith while growing up amid the pressures of American culture. Sabrina Boyd said, "My husband was not plotting. It's premature for everyone to jump on the guilty bandwagon." And leaders of the American or the Muslim American Society's Raleigh branch made a similar point earlier in the day at a news conference, urging media not to convict any of these people before they've had a trial. But Sabrina Boyd, 41-year-old mother of five, U.S.-born citizen, convert to Islam, reserved her sharpest comments for what she called a cruel trap that law enforcement authorities set up to get her out of her house Monday, 2 days ago, while agents scoured it for documents after the arrest of her husband, her two sons, and four other men. Now, she described what happened. She answered her door, knock on the door, she answered the door, and she found a man there that she thought was a family friend wearing a shirt that appeared to be bloodied. This man told her that her husband and their three sons, Dylan, Noah, and Zachariah, were in a serious car crash. He asked her to get into a highway patrol cruiser that was sitting there that would take her to Duke University Hospital, where the family, the three boys and the husband, were being treated. Sabrina Boyd called her daughter and her pregnant daughter-in-law. They wrapped their heads in scarves, grabbed the Qurans, and left. Got in the state police car, highway patrol car. Now, for Sabrina Boyd, this was a particularly painful experience because her 16-year-old son had died in a car crash near their home 2 years ago. Okay, so here we go. When they arrived at Duke Hospital, the police cruiser took them to a construction site at the rear of the facility, and a man dressed as a doctor came out and asked whether she was the wife of Daniel Boyd. When she said yes, this doctor, quote, extended his hand, but Sabrina said, "I do not shake men's hands." He then grabbed her wrist and handcuffed her. The guy then shouted at her, "I'm not a doctor, I'm an agent, and your family is not in the hospital. You're being detained, and you need to cooperate with us." Sabrina Boyd estimates she was surrounded then by 30 agents who frisked her and asked whether she had weapons or weapons of mass destruction. They drove her in a car. They separated from her daughter and her daughter-in-law, drove her in her car to the Johnson County Sheriff's Department, where she picked up her son, 15, one of the kids who she'd been told had been in a violent car wreck. Sabrina Boyd said she told the agents, "That was an awful dirty trick. You guys pulled a horrific lie on me and on my daughters. You know we've been through this before." Now, the district attorney involved in all this declined to respond to Sabrina Boyd's version. He said, quote, "I'm sticking to the four corners of the indictment. We try our cases in court and won't go back and forth before then," end quote. Sabrina Boyd said that the many trips the family made abroad, especially to Jerusalem, were pilgrimages to give her sons an exposure to the Arabic language and a chance to experience the daily rhythms of life in predominantly Muslim communities. She said, quote, "The point of a pilgrimage is to see the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock, to hear the call to prayer, and to make a prayer," end quote. Now, let me digress. How many young American Jewish boys and some girls also make a pilgrimage to Israel? Not to become residents of Israel, not to join the army, but to go to see the Wailing Wall, to hear the prayers being recited aloud, and watch the davening as the Orthodox Jews rapidly bow back and forth, right? American Jews do this as a matter of course. If they have the money, they send their boys and sometimes their girls to Israel. American Muslims, though, had better be careful if they do the same. Ms. Boyd said her husband and sons attempted to make two trips to Israel. The two boys, or the son and one of the boys, were admitted in 2006. 1 year later, when her husband wanted to take Zachariah Zechariah to Jerusalem to help him cope with his brother's death, the tour denied entry at the airport in Tel Aviv. And after being detained for 2 days, they were flown to France. Now there's more. We'll be right back.
Put your name.
Afraid? Be very afraid. It's Michael Moore.
25 before the hour. All right, so there you have the story of what happened to Daniel Boyd's spouse, Sabrina Boyd, and two of her daughters, or one of her daughters, one of her daughters-in-law, being told that her husband and three sons had been involved in a horrific car wreck, got in a state trooper's car, where she was taken someplace where she was handcuffed and detained. Is that where we are now? And, of course, the charges against Daniel Boyd, a European-American, Anglo, completely Caucasian, Anglo-European-American, and his three sons, or two of his sons, I think, two or three of his sons, and then four other people who are obviously of Middle Eastern extraction, although they are American citizens also. So here's a roundup of American citizens now being charged because, so far all we know, of course, maybe they, will reveal, maybe the feds will reveal that huge bomb-making factory was found in the basement of the Boyd's family, home in North Carolina, a suburban Raleigh. Although I tend to doubt it, this seems to be another one of those, like blowing up the Sears Tower or whatever the hell it is. Every time you turn around, holdovers, embedded racist thugs who still operate in the Justice Department, thanks to the Bush crime family, start busting another group of people. Now, I don't know, but so far, what's their record been? God damn it, all you have to do is look at the record. The Justice Department record, I mean. What their track record is so far. How many wins, how many losses? How many draws, right? But you also notice something. All these people we've heard about for the past year or two, American citizens. Remember the group down in Liberty City, a black suburb, or not, an inner city black neighborhood in Miami? Remember those guys? Whatever happened to them? They were busted. They were the ones who were going to blow up the Sears Tower, according to the indictment. What about the group, the Lackawanna Six and the Halawama This and the Gooba Gooba That and the Buffalo Nine and the Denver 34 and the Los Angeles 26? Well, you know, these people, media picks up on them, reports the story, and then they disappear. You don't hear anything about them again. Right? So here we have another group. The director of CAIR, CARE, the Council on Arab, American Islamic Relations. Council on, American Islamic Relations, CARE. The National Executive Director of that, a guy named Nihad Awad, wrote a letter to U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder that said in part, as a matter of principle, American Muslims repudiate terrorism in all its forms and support our nation's safety and security. Whether the suspects in this case are guilty or innocent, and everyone has a right to the presumption of innocence, let me digress. No, Mr. Awad, they don't. Not since 15 Saudis and four other people in the Middle East, if you want to believe the official story, came to this country and attacked the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and 3,000 people died. There is no longer a presumption of innocence for people with Middle Eastern names or Arabic names or names that sound Muslimy. No, sorry. But let's go back to what he wrote. Whether the suspects in this case are guilty or innocent, the cruel trick reportedly used by the FBI in the detention and questioning of the family members, shocks the conscience of anyone who values constitutional rights and due process. By falsely claiming that the father and sons had been injured in a car crash and thereby inducing the wife and other family members to get into a police vehicle, law enforcement authorities were in effect depriving those detained of the rights under the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, which guarantee that an individual is not deprived of liberty without due process of law, is secure in their home, and free from both unreasonable search and seizure and self-incrimination. I, Dr. Awad wrote, respectfully request that the U.S. Department of Justice investigate this incident to determine when and if the family members were informed of their constitutional rights, whether there was an arrest warrant for the female family members or a search warrant for the family home, and whether the cruel trick used to detain and question the family members is in fact permissible conduct for federal or state law enforcement authorities. The entire episode could have been avoided by having properly identified law enforcement authorities seek to interview the family members in their home after informing them of their constitutional rights. As you know, the protections of the Fifth Amendment grow out of the historical use of coercion and torture to extract confessions. I believe any reasonable person would conclude that the tactic used in this case amounts to psychological torture, particularly given the fact that one of the family's sons was killed in a car accident 2 years earlier. An unfortunate byproduct of such incidents is a decrease in the Muslim community's trust of legitimate law enforcement conduct. In another case recently reported to CARE, law enforcement authorities in Virginia allegedly falsely complained to be firefighters evacuating an apartment building in order to draw a Muslim from his home to facilitate his arrest. In June, Attorney General Holder, you committed to, quote, using criminal and civil rights laws to protect Muslim Americans, end quote. I respectfully ask that you demonstrate that commitment by investigating this disturbing incident and taking appropriate action based on the results of that investigation. No American should be subjected to such apparently unconstitutional law enforcement tactics, no matter what charges their family members face, end quote. Now, I have Muslim friends in this country. I mean, in this in the Atlanta area. Jewish friends, Muslim friends. I've told you this before. And some of my Arabic friends. Not all of them are Muslims, so I shouldn't have said that. My Arabic friends, a couple of them are Palestinian Christians, Lebanese Christians, Syrian Muslims, Palestinian Muslims. But Kathy and I have spent time with these folks over the years. We've been in each other's homes. We had a friend of ours who is Jewish go to Israel on the Eyewitness Israel program. 20 years ago, to document the atrocities being committed by the IDF against Palestinians. And my friend is a photojournalist and also happens to be Jewish, and he went, put together a slideshow, brought it home, and we had an evening, a gathering, in the home of a Arab-speaking Palestinian, PhD. Invited a lot of prominent Jews and Arab speakers in Atlanta to come and view the slideshow. And it was very impressive. We had a communal meal. It was all Middle Eastern food. And it was, you know, a little attempt to crack open that door a little bit of understanding between Arabs and Jews, at least here. I also have participated, a friend of mine who's Syrian said, you know, this is about 10 years ago, we are trying to build a relationship of trust with the FBI. Actually, this was after 2001, so it wasn't 10 years ago. We're trying to build a trust. So what we've been doing is attending these meetings where FBI send representatives who are involved in counterterrorism to come and speak to Middle Eastern groups of mostly men. Very few women attend these, very few Muslim women. And my friend said, you know, would you like to come along? And so I said, yeah, sure, I'll go. So I went to one of these meetings where the Muslim community in Atlanta tries to make it clear to the FBI community in Atlanta that they, the Muslims, are not involved in any acts of terror. They have to prove their innocence over and over and over and over again. The FBI, for their part, at these meetings, at least the one I attended, tries to convince the Muslim community of what to watch out for, of how to respond if they are stopped and questioned. You know, how to deal with racial profiling, because it's going to happen. What to tell your family if you are asked to voluntarily come in for questioning to an FBI office, because maybe a business connection of yours in the Middle East has just been involved in some sort of activity in the Middle East that the FBI wants to describe as proto-terrorism or possible to, you know, that sort of thing. So I sat in this meeting and was blown away. I watched these men, these Arabic or Muslim speakers, Arabic speakers or Muslim men, Christian men, all Middle Easterners, submitting themselves to willingly to this kind of situation, to the point where at one point, I raised my hand to ask a question, and the FBI agent called on me, and rather than ask a question, I made a statement about how I thought what was going on in this meeting was kind of outside the parameters of what it was supposed to be. And immediately, some of these Muslim men hushed me, you know, shh, shh, shh. And later, when we broke for tea, a couple of them took me aside and said, don't do this. Let us handle it. Celebrate the next 100 years of engineering excellence at the GMC Summer Event. Check out the legendary 09 Sierra 1500 or the 8-passenger Acadia. Visit GMCDealer.com. Take delivery by July 31st. See dealer for details.
Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away.
10 before the hour. The Justice Department has to either be aware of or certainly clear this type of action taken by U.S. attorneys, no matter where it occurs. The truth is, what I mentioned earlier, the Bush crime family left embedded in so many positions. They switched these appointees in various departments of the government. They switched them from appointees to civil service positions, which means it's either impossible to fire them or you have to go through hell to do so. Now, I don't know what the situation is with this U.S. attorney in North Carolina. I really don't. And nobody knows at this point, other than the investigating team, what was found in Daniel Boyd's house. But what we do know is very simple stuff. You know, they did this to Jose Padilla until they drove him crazy. This is what Republicans do. This kind of horror perpetrated against a woman, a mother of five, who is told there's been a car accident and your husband and sons are at Duke University Medical Center. You need to come now. We've got a state highway patrol car here to get you there. And then they do this. Now, we're aware of, because it was publicized, it became a matter of public knowledge for anyone who wanted to check out the information, that certain people that we swept up in Afghanistan and Iraq and taken to our torture facilities were forced to endure what they thought were the screams of their children in a different room. And one particular terror suspect, I believe, was actually shown his son. They actually brought his son in, or his wife, or both. This is really vile stuff. We, of course, under the Bush-Cheney crime family, entered into a realm of behavior, official behavior, that is not Orwell, and it's not Kafka. It's unique. It's Cheney. It's Bush. But is this what we've become? And the quick answer is, yeah, well, hell yeah. What do you mean, is it? What kind of a question you asking, Malloy? Of course it is. Of course it is. Now, the fact that the ringleader is a European-American, Caucasian, with a kind of middle American name, you know, and he's blonde. You've seen his pictures. Cute guy, blonde, looks like somebody you would hang out with. Daniel Boyd. And, of course, the story given by his family is that the charges, of course, are nonsense. Absolute nonsense. So we'll see what happens. Who's to say that the family members of Daniel Boyd are fully aware of what their husband, father may or may not have been doing? Who's to say? Who's to say? But it's astonishing to me that where it concerns these kinds of arrests, the United States Constitution doesn't apply any longer. Now, I've heard the argument, well, you know, Malloy, on foreign soil with foreign people, it doesn't apply, even though we're doing the detaining and the torturing and the killing. Okay, I guess people of a certain level of craziness can make that argument. But what about American people, American citizens who live here, American born? What about a mother of five? What about a father of five? All Americans, no rights there, nothing. The Constitution no longer applies. No Fourth Amendment, no Fifth Amendment, nothing. If we want to come to your house and tell you that your spouse has been mangled in a car wreck. Now, if you drop dead of a heart attack from that news, oops, sorry. Guess we screwed up there a little bit. But all we want you to do, ladies, get in the car and come see your mangled sons and your husband. Quickly. You know, Allah needs you there. So you can read from your Holy Quran and everything will be okay, right? Huh, lady, isn't that what you do? And then to find out some evil son of a bitch. Now, you know, I'm waiting to handcuff her. I've tried today when I got the story, I've tried to think to myself, what kind of person, American person just like me, speaks English, grew up the same way I did, what kind of person can put this kind of a trap together? What kind of a person can go to a mother who 2 years ago had a son killed in a car wreck, go to a mother and say, your husband and your three sons have been mangled. You need to come with us now. What kind of a person could do it? Now, I know Dick Cheney could do it. I know Karl Rove could do it. But this was somebody that she thought was a family friend. She wasn't sure. And the guy shows up with what appeared to be a bloody shirt on. Oh, nice touch, you filthy goddamn idiots. Nice touch. Way to go. That's really good. Who did that for you? The makeup guy at the FBI office in Raleigh? So, we're going to take a break and come back, and we'll take your phone calls and other stuff like that. We have we've fallen so far. We really, really have, haven't we? Yeah. Yeah, we have. There's no longer any need for even pretense anymore. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy Program. Now, most everybody knows who Martin Niemöller was. He was a German pastor and theologian. He was an anti-communist, and he supported Hitler's rise to power at first. But when Hitler started to go insane, insisting on the supremacy of the state over religion, Niemöller became the leader of a group of German clergymen opposed to Hitler. And as a result of that, he, he had to leave the country or die, be murdered. Excuse me. But he, if you remember what he's famous for, he's the one who made the statement about first they came for, first they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't say anything, and I didn't speak out. And then they came for the socialists, and I'm not a socialist, so I didn't speak out. Then they came for the whoever it was, and finally they came for the Jews, and I'm not a Jew, so I didn't speak out. When they finally came for me, there was no one left to speak out. So every time I see a case, but this one in particular, this one about Sabrina Boyd and Daniel Boyd, and again, it may turn out that Daniel Boyd was ready to plant a nuclear bomb in underneath the Lincoln Memorial. And frankly, that is not a reason. If he were ready to do that, the FBI and the DIA and the NSA and everybody else would have known about it a long time ago. But if we got to the point now where a story like this can occur in North Carolina, outside Raleigh, North Carolina, be reported by a major newspaper, it was reported by the New York Times, reported by the Washington Post, and then this background piece reported by the Raleigh News and Observer about what happened to the family. And we all sit here on our asses and don't do anything? We come on, Molloy, they're Muslims. Oh, okay. Come on, Molloy. They're hanging out with swarthy, dark-skinned men. Oh, okay. Come on, Molloy. Did you see the names of those people? Awad al-Mashuri or whatever the hell it was, right? That's not Joe Smith. But the guy who was popped as the ringleader was named Daniel Boyd. And his wife is Sabrina Boyd. And their kids all had pretty much biblical names, right? So here we all sit. Did you hear anything about this story other than on from the Raleigh News and Observer that I just talked about? I don't know. I've seen nothing about it on the air. I heard about the bust. But the bust is nothing new. I mean, this happens to people because they're black or because they have Arabic names or because they're Muslim or because on and on and on and on again. Look what happened to the Cambridge, what the Cambridge police did to the Harvard professor, Henry Louis Gates. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. But this is crazy. If we're not going to speak out for a family, an American family, who have the full, unequivocal protection of the U.S. Constitution. There's no gray area here. I mean, nobody can say, well, Mike, it wasn't on U.S. soil. Yes, it was. Well, Mike, they're not American citizens. Yes, they are. Well, Mike, they weren't American citizens. They've always been. So who else, if not this family, is entitled to the full protection of the U.S. Constitution? Who? I mean, seriously, who? And the other three or four men whose pictures have been put out there, ooh, scary, they're dark-skinned, ooh, they have big noses, ooh, they have Arabic names, ah, they have bushy eyebrows, ooh. Is this what we've come to? Son of a bitch, you know what? It is. This is exactly what we've come to. Exactly. And that doesn't inspire us to demand justice. Good God. Now remember what Martin Niemöller said. When they finally came for him, there was no one left to protest. He watched as they came for this group and that group and this group and that group. But since he wasn't associated with any of those folks, no, I'm not a Jew. No, I'm not a trade unionist. No, I'm not a communist. No, I'm not a liberal. No, I'm not a whatever. He didn't raise his voice. So, you know, I lived in Raleigh. I went to school in Raleigh. I went to NC State. Did not graduate from NC State. Actually, didn't graduate from any university. But attended NC State for two or three semesters way back in 1970. I'm familiar with that area. I lived there when they had huge billboards on the roads from Raleigh out to Rocky Mount or Wilson or wherever. Big billboards, huge billboards with a man in a Klan hood on the back of a rearing white horse. Huge billboard. Sign said, "This is Klan country." Yeah, I've lived in Raleigh. I lived in Raleigh when Jesse Helms was a commentator for the Tobacco News Network. Some of the garbage he used to pump into the airwaves every day was amazing. But the reason I bring that up, what do the good Christian white people do in the suburbs of Raleigh? That would be Garner and Cary and Fuquay Arena and all those little towns. And I believe this bust happened near Garner, North Carolina. What do the good Christian white people, the Baptists and the Presbyterians and the Lutherans, what do they do now? This family who looked exactly like them, except when the wife and the daughters went out in public, they covered themselves, as is required by their faith, as do Orthodox Jewish women. What are the good white Christians, Americans all, going to do in Raleigh now? Now that they know that in their midst, the FBI tricked a woman whose son had been killed in a car wreck, tricked her into believing that her husband and two of her other sons were involved in a horrible smash-up, and then busted her. What are the good white Christians going to do in Raleigh? Huh? Yeah. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Because for a lot of those good white Christians, these people are guilty as hell. Absolutely guilty. What are they charged with? Yeah, well, goddamn right. Lock them up. Lock them up. Throw away the key. Send them Guantanamo. I can't wait till that pissant Glenn Beck gets his hands on this story. Or Rush Limbaugh. Or Sean Hannity. Or that crazy skinny blonde. Or But when I got this story, I just, you know, regardless of the outcome of the trial, what are the good white Christian folks and the good black Christian folks in Raleigh, North Carolina, going to do about what happened in their midst the other day? And I had to deal with a horrible answer. Not a goddamn thing.
Put from pen to paper, turns me into a godless one. history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me,
do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. Now I'm starting to get emails from people wanting to know where the story came from. It came from the Raleigh News-Observer, the Raleigh newspaper. I think it was in today's story. Just go to the Raleigh Observer, News Observer, do a site search for Sabrina. Sabrina Boyd or Daniel Boyd, and you'll get the information. What a story. Catherine is in Tucson. Hey, Catherine.
Hi. While I've been on hold, I've been Googling Liberty City 7.
Uh-huh.
Not all were found not guilty instead in the second trial. In 2008, there was a hung jury for the second time after 13 days of deliberation.
Right.
One was found not guilty. The government is still trying to decide whether to have a third trial. And the government expert was paid $1,000 for his court appearance, taxpayer funds, of course, and $75 an hour to review the documents.
Mm-hmm.
They were accused of, quote, conspiring to support Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
But the plan to destroy the buildings was originated by the FBI informer. The ringleader, a Haitian, is still in jail in Dade County in the immigration facility because he's a green card holder,
mm-hmm.
and the crimes of which he is accused are deportable, but hasn't been found guilty. So he's not entitled to speedy justice because why? I don't get it. I am so sick of this whole thing.
I know.
Sick of everything that's going on. Country is this? It's not mine anymore.
No. No, this is, this is as bad as the Soviet Union ever got. It's as bad as any totalitarian state. Soviet Union, Cambodia, China, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Most of us who grew up in this country and learned about our founding documents understood from the get-go that all the flowery speech was wonderful, but this country was founded on racism and genocide. So it's pretty hard when you're building your nation on genocide and racism. It's pretty hard to talk about all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights.
If you're white and male and rich, yeah, it's okay.
Right.
But wait a minute. I'd like to say to the lady who, the birther who stood up, hey, I want my country back. Anything wrong with that?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Catherine. Appreciate you checking in. The only rationale that I've been able to come up with as an adult that stops me from just looking at the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence as being an absolute side-splitting, screamingly funny put-on for the British 232 years ago is the fact that most of the framers, I believe, were of the belief that the documents they were putting together were documents that had to, that the country or the people had to rise to the level of those documents. Now, that may be a false belief on my part, wishful thinking, because we had to kill 600,000 or 700,000 Americans in the Civil War. We had to wipe out an entire people in the destruction of Native Americans. We don't visit that. I live in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains. And because of that, I'm aware of the Trail of Tears. I'm aware of what happened to the Cherokee Nation in this country. It's just astonishing. But that might be given a couple, three lines in a history book, American history book, and then it's just, you know, just kind of skimmed over. The only saving grace for me as somebody who wants to live in a country where justice and truth really do prevail, where there is justice. I mean, everything else flows from that. So I don't even have to say truth, just justice. The only way I've been able to manage the reality of my country and the ideal or the goal of the country is to tell myself that when the country is put together, they had no idea of the vast Native American population here. They had no idea that slavery was going to develop into what it did develop into. And again, okay, don't email me and tell me I'm just crazier than a loon. I don't know my history. I'm telling you this is my way of rationalizing the truth of what I know about my country. Okay, that's all. So don't send me emails and tell me I'm stupid or ignorant or naive. Don't. Because, well, go ahead if you want to. I'll just delete the goddamn things. But I'm trying to make a point here. Anybody who believes in the documents that are the foundation of this country, you've got to have a come-to-Jesus moment when you look at those documents and then look at our history and say, wait a minute, this is not what happened. So how do you process that? You say, well, there was an ideal and a reality. Oh, okay. And here we are 232 years later, and the documents are decaying. They're rotting. They're being eaten by worms and boll weevils and all kinds of vermin that are just eating what Bush called that goddamn piece of paper. They're just devouring it, shredding it, eating it. It's disappearing. And believe it or not, that's upsetting to me. Your phone calls when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy.
Life's too short to listen to right-wing radio. Here's Mike Malloy.
Time for retribution. Here comes the revolution.
It's about 25 before the hour. All right, back to your calls. Douglas is in Sacramento, California. Hey, Douglas.
Hey, Mike. Good to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to get to talk to Tom Hartman, I think, on the 4th.
Yeah? What happens on the 4th?
Oh, he's going to be in San Francisco, which is within my reach.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, we're all going to be in Seattle on the 8th.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit too far out of my reach. But
oh, okay.
One of these days, maybe. But anyway, I was thinking about what you said, and I think the kind of people who do this kind of thing are the kind of people who believe in the attractiveness of sin. I think I'd put it that way.
Now you're talking about the people who set up this woman into believing that her family had been injured severely in a car crash.
Yeah, I mean, this goes way back to the founding of the country. It's we saw huge examples of it during the anti-communist hysteria, but the idea that anything bad is inherently more attractive.
I'm not sure I understand that, Douglas.
Well, with the fundamentalists, I mean, we are all basically sinners, so sin is inherently more attractive to us.
Okay.
So, anybody against us puts us automatically on the defensive, at least in their minds.
You're a little bit deep for me tonight, pal. Most of this is buzzing right by me. Of course, it may be because I'm, half scrambled on narcotic cough syrup. Tell me how this applies to the Sabrina Boyd case.
Okay, well, they're Muslims. They gave up on us. They're sinners.
Oh, I see what you're saying, right.
So they're all, and they're, because of that, they're inherently attractive. They're inherently calling people to their side just by existing. So that kind of justifies anything in return. We go back to God's laws, which is you stamp out unbelievers.
Right. Of course, the irony to me about all this, Douglas, is that Muslims, Christians, and Jews all believe in the same God and the same, you know, Abraham. They are all three of these religions are Abrahamic. Is that the way to say it? Abrahamic. And this is just, you know, another reason, and I've said I've got many, but, and Doug, thanks, appreciate it. This is another reason that I find religion to be madness, just complete madness. Having said that, if somebody wants to practice a religious belief because it gives them sustenance, spiritual sustenance, or peace, so be it. You know, I go back to the John Lennon line, whatever gets you through the night. I don't have any problem with people being religious. Not at all. Unless they start to wage a war in the name of that religion. Unless they feel that their religion is so superior to everything else that they can come and kill me. Or the people that run my country feel that their religion is so important and so primary that we can go kill someone else. I mean, that's where it gets maddening. Or if the religion tries to tell me that the universe is 6,000 years old, or if the religion tries to tell me that certain poems or stories are obscene because they have the F word, or because they, you understand what I'm saying. You understand what I'm saying. And especially the religions that look at me and point a long bony finger and say, you know, you're doomed. I condemn you to everlasting hell because you don't believe. Why? What did I do? Well, you don't believe the way I believe. Oh, so for that, I'm condemned to hell. Yes. Oh, okay. Bite me. You know, I mean, that's my attitude. That's so anyway, it's a lot deeper than that. I don't mean to get off on this tangent again. I get sick of going off this tangent. The point I think I'm trying to make is that these folks, especially the wife and the kids, I don't know about the husband. He hasn't had a story yet like Sabrina's story, being told her family's been wiped out in a car wreck and she needs to come in to the hospital. And then it's a ruse and they bust her. I mean, to me, that is vile. That is unspeakable. That is murderous. That is unchristian. How about that? Doesn't it say somewhere about not bearing false witness? I mean, that's the part that stinks. It's this putrid stench that to me just permeates people who use religion like this. Whatever. You know my take on that. Warren is in Revere, Massachusetts. Warren, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
The last time I tried to call into your show was the day that that you were disappeared from Air America, and I spoke to Peter Werby instead.
Oh, my God, really?
And I've been listening since I was homeless on the streets of Boston.
I remember talking to you.
No, you never have.
Oh, I don't. Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you called.
In regards to this, I want to be kind of quick because I know there's other people. I'm surprised I got through. In regards to this story about this family, I've been hearing bits and pieces of it on NPR.
Yeah.
I wonder how far this kind of NSA wiretap police state business has gone. The other day I was talking to my son, and nobody could call me, you know, a Muslim or a terrorist or anything. Maybe I've said some things that you wouldn't say on your radio show that...
Yeah?
I've been pretty enraged at these right-wing nut jobs, you know?
Right.
I was homeless for 7 years. I got pretty enraged.
I hear you.
The other day I'm talking to my son, and he heard it, and he acknowledges it. It sounded like a jackhammer coming onto our phone. I was telling my son about how the Bush-Cheney crime family initiated this NSA wiretap business.
Uh-huh.
I was explaining from my limited pool of knowledge how this thing came about.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to my knowledge, it hasn't been discontinued under Obama.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it sounded like a jackhammer came onto my phone. I know this sounds kind of tinfoil hat-like, but...
Not at all.
It's the gospel truth, even though I don't believe in the gospel. And a voice came booming over the phone. It reminds me of that point in 1984 where they say, "You are the dead."
Yeah.
Where they catch them in the hotel room and...
Yeah, where the voice comes out of what appears to be the mirror.
I heard you read 1984. And this voice said, "You know what's up. It is what it is."
Mm-hmm.
And then disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how far... You know, we know that Verizon and various... I'm on Verizon right now. Our various phone companies, AT&T, what have you... I was a communications major in college. I mean, these companies, this corporatism, like, just in lock sync with the government. How far has it gone?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
no, I do
can,
know.
Can any of us feel safe ever having a conversation anywhere?
No, you know? I don't think ever again, Warren, anybody who uses a telephone, email, cell phones, whatever, should ever assume any longer that, or snail mail, that your correspondence is private, because it is not. It no longer is. Warren, thank you. I appreciate you. I hope you call again. It is not private any longer. The little dribs and drabs of information that came out about the NSA spying authorized by Dick Cheney, that spying was massive. It included hundreds of millions, if not billions, of communications back and forth. Too many to sort through. I mean, to listen to all of them. I'm sure they used programs, algorithms, looking for keywords that would pop up, you know, certain communications, yada, yada, yada. But I think anyone who now assumes that anything that you write that goes through the web, or any phone call that you make on your cell phone or even on your landline, to make the assumption that is only being read or heard or spoken by you or the person to whom it's going is delusional. It's just absolutely delusional. Now, I'm not saying that every single phone call, every single email, every single letter is opened or monitored. But the inverse of that, come to the inverse conclusion that everyone is not being monitored or read, is insane. We know that they are. So I think this these breakdowns in constitutional protections are going to continue until the Constitution will be what it has been probably for a long time, but it'll finally come to pass. It'll be a museum piece. It'll be something like the Rosetta Stone, something that historians will look at and just say, "Wow, look at that. Can you understand what that means?" "No, I don't know what freedom of speech means." "What does that mean?" "Of course I have freedom of speech. I can say anything they'll let me say." So, I don't know. But yeah, I hear you. Communications, all communications are monitored. We'll be right back.
And they say, "Open up, we're coming inside. You can't run, so you might."
Celebrate the next 100 years of engineering excellence at the GMC Summer Event. Check out the legendary 09 Sierra 1500 or the 8-passenger Acadia. Visit GMCDealer.com. Take delivery by July 31st. See dealer for details. It's 10 before the hour. Tim is in Detroit. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, I want to go back to a story you were talking about earlier. It had to do with David Gregory emailing Governor Sanford, telling him basically he had carte blanche on Meet the Press. He could frame the discussion any way he wanted.
Right.
And I think this illustrates pretty much the corporate nature of the media. This whole nonsense about how they claim that they are somehow objective and give the relevant facts is not true now, and it hasn't been true for a long time. And I think with this story, with the Sabrina Boyd story, if the media gets a hold of it, it's going to be again framed. I mean, you know, this woman, I mean, she's a Muslim. She might have ties to quote-unquote terrorists. And, of course, we have to give the government the so-called credit for going after her. So it's more of the same nonsense that we put up with.
Well, McClatchy newspapers have picked up the story now, and of any so-called news organization in the United States, McClatchy is probably the one that subscribes most fully to journalistic standards. They are reporting it straight up, as I did. So as the Raleigh News and Observer, and as one of our callers said, the story has been reported all day on NPR, which I also believe is reporting it straight up. But the people who will take this story and twist it into something hideous, obscene, and use it to manipulate yet more Americans are people like Glenn Beck, or Bill O'Reilly, or Sean Hannity, or Rush Limbaugh. These are people who will take a story like this and completely twist it beyond recognition and probably come to the conclusion that the cops who told this woman, or the FBI who told this woman her family had been in a car wreck, had done exactly what they should have done. Because after all, these people are Muslims, and if they are terrorists, okay, then they're Muslim terrorists. You see what I mean? So I don't think, now the rest of media, the rest of mainstream media would just ignore the story. They don't care.
Well, the thing is, Mike, too, I think what you just said, the whole meme about somehow the woman is at fault for just being a Muslim, I think it may actually start, let's say, with the Limbaughs and the Becks as sort of a right-wing talking point. But then I've noticed a lot of these right-wing talking points make their way to the mainstream press.
Yeah, they do.
And they're given legitimacy. And that's always my main criticism with media in this country. It never goes to the left for any sort of analysis. It always goes to the drudges and so on. And it takes these really far-right fascistic memes, and the next thing you know, you find it on your TV screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right, and that's the part, and thank you, Tim. I need to leave it there. That's the part that is, if I can use this word, worrisome to me. I don't have any illusions about my country, but I do have some illusions about what I thought were the standards to which we were supposed to aspire, at least, anyway. I mean, where it concerns justice. And to do a filthy trick like this to a woman or a man, if the situation would have been turned around, you know, if they wanted him and said your wife and two daughters have just been in a vicious car wreck, but it was her and they told her that her husband, would they have done that to a Baptist? Think about that for a second. Would they have done it to a Catholic? Would they have done it to somebody Jewish? I don't know what the answers are, but I have a feeling that the answers are no. They would not have. They would have used deeply deceptive tactics nonetheless, but not that one. But because she was a Muslim, an American Muslim, a convert, as you just pointed out, then she is somehow very much an apostate. I mean, you don't be Muslim and be an American. That's the attitude that's being put out there. That's the attitude that's been put out there since the attack of September 11, 2001, if you want to believe that fairy story. So when you have people like, what's her name, the tall, skinny blonde, Ann Coulter, writing books or making statements about we should invade the Muslim countries, kill their leaders and convert them to Christianity or whatever the hell it was she said. You know, it makes my blood run cold. I just think, how does this society produce that kind of vermin? How does this society, I know the answer, don't email me. How does this society produce American citizens who will go to another American citizen, and I'm going to use that as the touchstone, and say, you know, your family's just been in a hideous traffic accident, so they can lure them away and get the cooperation of the state police the FBI, and the Justice Department to do this to this woman. Son of a bitch! I mean, it's just with no concern whatsoever to her emotional or mental state upon hearing those words after the fact that 2 years ago one of her sons did die in a car wreck. And then to grab her. Would they have grabbed an Orthodox Jewish woman who also is not supposed to touch anyone other than her husband or have them touch her? Would they have grabbed a fundamentalist Christian? But you see this woman. And it was only after she said, you know, when the cop reached out, disguised as a doctor, and he reaches out his hand to shake hands, hi, and she says, I'm sorry, my religion forbids me from touching another man, he grabs her. After she just told him. Now, why wasn't there a woman FBI cop there? You see what I'm saying? The disrespect here, the absolute breakdown of even essential human respect for another person is just unreal. She's an American? Oh, really? She's Caucasian? Oh, really? She's European American? Oh, really? And she's a goddamn Muslim? Are you kidding me? She converted? She what? Oh, well, we'll get her. So immediately, she's not even worth telling a story to other than her family. It's just been wiped out. I'm going to have a hard time with this one. I really am. Because this is done in my country, in my name, to protect me from what? Terrorism? This is terrorism. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. I'm Mike Malloy. Keep it lit.